let's not talk very long because the people who normally ask a lot of questions aren't here. So, that's fine though because it's a holiday tomorrow, so you know, relaxing. I wanted to talk today about atmospheres, sort of in general, as a way to talk about gas giants. But we should start with the one that's the most important to us, Earth's atmosphere, because, you know, you're breathing it in right now, so we should talk about it. Just as a quick overview, the percent by the number of molecules, not by mass, but it's pretty close to these numbers. If you do it by mass instead, it's 78% nitrogen in a molecule, N2, 21% oxygen in a molecule, O2, 1% argon, and 0.04% carbon dioxide. It's a troublesome 0.04%. Getting bigger every day. And trace amounts of neon, helium, methane, this is CH4, and krypton. Not the Superman thing, that's kryptonite. This is the gas krypton. Anyway, that's Earth's atmosphere in terms of the component parts. If you think about the other terrestrial planets in the solar system, right, Mercury doesn't really have an atmosphere. It's got sort of a weird trace thing. Sometimes things get caught in craters and that counts as an atmosphere sometimes. Not much is going on. It's too close to the sun. Venus has another nitrogen-dominated atmosphere, but it's got way more CO2 in it and sulfur and stuff. So that's why it's got this crazy greenhouse effect that I think you probably talked about last week sometime. And that greenhouse effect makes it really hot on the surface. Earth's atmosphere is much more normal in terms of composition. That's normal being good for us, meaning. And then Mars has a lot more CO2, but it's much thinner in terms of its density, so it basically doesn't have, it's too far away from the sun, so it doesn't get particularly too warm, the same way that Venus does, because it's much thinner, the pressure is much lower, but you get surface temperatures on Mars that are sort of similar to like a chilly spring day at the warmest. So you could walk around on Mars. You'd need a pressure suit, but it would be warm enough that it wouldn't be like absolutely freezing. But we here are in the Goldilocks zone, right? We have the nice atmosphere, we have the nice temperature, we have a decent pressure on our surface. If you want to use the convenient units, it's one atmosphere. But what we see here over here on the right, sea level pressure, right, what we're talking about, that's defined at the surface of the ocean, right? That's about 10 to the fifth newtons per square meter if you want to use physics units. The pressure gradient, right, as you go up away from the surface, the pressure goes down because the amount of stuff you have goes down, right? The density goes down as you go up as well. It follows the ideal gas law and the law of hydrostatic equilibrium, which we talked about when we talked about the interior of the sun. Same thing follows for the atmosphere of the Earth, but instead of the pressure distribution that we found for the interior of the sun, which is more complicated because the density is a complicated system inside the sun. If you put everything together for the Earth's atmosphere, it follows a simple exponential. So pressure at a given height above the surface goes as whatever the initial pressure at sea level is, and then decays as e to the negative r minus the radius of the Earth. So you start at the surface, or you don't start at the center of the Earth, divided by some scale height, h. So the Earth's radius is 6,378 kilometers, and you start out with a pressure of one atmosphere, and then the scale height is equal to KT, where T is the surface temperature, which is something like, what is it, 300, 200 270-ish Kelvin. Divided by the gravitational acceleration, which again we can assume for the because the atmosphere is so thin relative to the Earth, we can assume it's just 9.8 meters per second squared for the whole thing. And then the mean molecular weight, mu, of the atmosphere. So if you can sort of think based on, you know, you have heavy-ish stuff, you have nitrogen, you have oxygen, argon, CO2, that's all sort of high molecular weight, like you've got a lot of protons in there, a lot of neutrons. I think the mean molecular weight, I think they say in the book it's something like 29 times the mass of a proton. I think that's right. If you work all that out together, you get that the scale height is equal to about 8 kilometers above sea level. So what scale height means, right, is as you go up, after you go up one scale height, the amount of pressure that you have has dropped by 1/E, so that you have 37% approximately of what the pressure was at the surface. So 8 kilometers is about the altitude of Mount Everest. It's actually a little higher. Mount Everest goes above the scale height by about another kilometer. So if you go, if you climb to the top of Mount Everest, you have 37% of the pressure that you had at sea level, which is why you want to bring oxygen with you if you climb to the top of a mountain, right? There's not as much pressure there to get it into your lungs as there was at sea level. If you go up another scale height, right, you drop to another 37% of what you were at, so you drop off pretty quickly. So if you go up about 3 scale heights, 24 kilometers, right, are at about 95%. You have about 5% left of the pressure that you had on the surface. Steve?
How far can we go up before we need to worry about the atmosphere still being there?
Still being there?
Yeah.
Like at all? Infinity.
Okay.
Theoretically, right? I mean, you can keep going, and eventually you mix into what we would call the interplanetary medium, which has, you know, there's particles.
Let's say a jetpack, though.
Jetpack?
Yeah.
I'm not an aeronautical engineer.
Well, like, how far up would I need before I put on a helmet to breathe?
I would probably not go much past 8 kilometers.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to want to bring some supplemental air pressure above that. It's not going to work out great for you. I mean, planes, right, they fly above that, and those are pressurized cabins, right, for, like, big jets. They go up past 15 kilometers sometimes. Yeah, Kevin.
How high would you go until you get, like, would you get the bends if you went up a certain height?
I do not know how that works.
You have to go up really fast.
Yeah.
Nope.
I think it's... Do you know? Like, getting nitrogen in your blood too much? That's higher pressure.
Yeah, that's like ocean things.
Yeah.
Ocean?
I don't know. I'm going to be honest. Ask a biologist. I have no idea. I don't know about anatomy or any of that, so I imagine that you would probably have more of an issue with having enough oxygen on the time scale that you have to worry about your blood exploding or whatever. That shows you to the extent that I know about how that stuff works. Your blood's not exploding, but here's a little diagram of height, right? So sea level is here at the bottom, and then temperature along the x-axis. So down here at the surface, we are at about 50, 60, 70, 290 Kelvin, right? So sort of room temperature-ish. And so this is in 5, 10, 15, 20 kilometers, right? So one scale height is about here or so. And then, so you can basically see as you go up, the temperature sort of bounces around. Remember that we define temperature in a weird way in physics. It's not how you feel necessarily, it's how fast the particles are moving. So this is a sort of a function there of particle speed and how you get energy into those particles. As you go up in the lowest layer, the troposphere, which is where we live, right, the temperature drops. But then you get to the bottom of the top of the troposphere, and then it starts to get warmer again in the stratosphere. And then you get to another boundary, and you have the mesosphere, where it's dropping. And then you get to the thermosphere, where it starts to get really hot, because the number of particles is very low, and there's nothing stopping the particles from bumping into each other, so they can just zoom around really fast, right? So it measures hot, even though you feel cold. Right? You only feel temperature when you interact with a particle that has energy. So if you have very low densities, you're not transferring that energy to you and you don't feel warm. I guess I do know a little bit about biology. I don't know. So these layers, right, they're defined by when you turn around the temperature gradient, right? So if you're going up, you start out hot and you get cold and then it switches, right? So you define the change in the layer there. You get hot and then you start getting cold again. You get another flip, it's another layer. The thermosphere, right, as you can see, it gets hot. It just keeps going up. Because you are in a hot environment, that means that you are more likely to have an ionized particle. You can get energy enough to get the electron out. So you can have positively charged particles in the thermosphere. That's called the ionosphere. We talk about the regions that are full of charged particles. The ionosphere is good and bad in a lot of ways, right? The ionosphere keeps some kinds of radiation out, but it also keeps some kind of radiation in. Right, so you can bounce radio waves off the ionosphere, which means that we can actually communicate via radio with the other side of the Earth, because you can go and bounce it for further distances than you could. But it also means that you can't observe radio in long wavelengths, also from outside. Right, you can only see things that are inside. It's just like a shell of charged particles that you can't see through. The mesosphere. Is meso means middle, right? So it's just sort of the layer in between. There's not a lot going on there, but that's where the density starts to go up enough that most meteors burn up in the mesosphere, because that's the density is high enough to actually provide enough friction to transfer energy into those particles. The stratosphere is where things start to get interesting. Strato means layers. So in the stratosphere, you have layers of laminar flow, so you don't have any turbulence happening, there's no convection going on, so you just have layers. That's why planes fly there, because there's not a lot of turbulence. You can just pick a layer and be smooth. And the stratosphere is also where the ozone layer is, and that's really good, because that keeps us from getting sunburns and all the bad things that happen when you get sunburns. Wear sunscreen. My professional advice, don't look at the sun and wear sunscreen. The sun is bad for you. And then troposphere, tropo means turning. And so this is where you have convection cells. So all the weather is because of convection. All the weather, you know, clouds, rain, all that stuff happens because of convection. So that's where all the interesting stuff in the atmosphere happens, is in the troposphere, sort of that bottom 10 kilometers or so. And that's also where most of the atmosphere is, right? So if you think about density distributions, 80% of the material in the atmosphere is contained in the bottom 10 kilometers. So that's where all the mass is, that's where most of the water is, that's why you get weather, that's why it all happens down here in the bottom layer. What's the definition of space, right? Is it 60 kilometers?
I think so, yeah.
So space starts here. If you want to think about, like, you know, NASA's definition, if you go into space, you have to go up this high. 60 kilometers is not that far along the surface of the Earth, right? It doesn't take you that long to go 60 kilometers.
I mean, for context, on a typical classroom globe, not that, but like one plastic, the atmosphere, to scale, the atmosphere is as thin as the lacquer on the surface of that globe. And it's not a lot.
Right. Is there a scale bar on here anywhere?
No.
And you can sort of imagine, right, if you could put a coat of paint on this, that's how thick the atmosphere would be.
Like, to that, like, arbitrary space boundary, or, like, to the edge of the thermosphere?
Honestly, all of it.
Right, so they sort of talk about the thermosphere ends at 500 kilometers, and that's when it sort of merges with the solar system, the interplanetary medium. Sort of an arbitrary definition. So if you say 500 kilometers out, that's not the atmosphere anymore. That's still really small compared to the size of the Earth, right? The Earth is 6,378 kilometers in radius. And so, what, a 12th of that is atmosphere? That's not pretty big. That's not very big. Convection is the most important. Sorry, Steve, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering if Venus and Mars had comparable sphere layers.
On some level, probably.
Do we not?
They don't talk about it in the book, really.
I don't think theirs has a mesosphere, the part that comes jutting back in and then back out again. I think theirs just makes a nice U in their structure. I don't think they have mesospheres.
Because there were probes, at least on Venus, right? They were like sucking up all the nastiness.
Yeah.
So we could measure that.
Like, yeah.
And what's happening. I was just wondering, like, that, can I see that, but on Venus?
I think Ray is probably right that it's not an M shape, right? It's more of just a U, right? So it probably just gets cooler, and then as you sort of pass through, it starts to get warmer again as things thin out. But I think the main difference is compositional.
Sure.
Right? Venus is going to have a lot more heavy stuff in the atmosphere because of all that greenhouse gas. So that's going to mess with the mean molecular weight. It's going to mess with the distributions. It's going
to
change how convection works,
back
right?
To that other
There's all this. It's a more complicated process, right? So, and then Mars has a much thinner atmosphere, so you probably are going to reach this sort of. There's not going to be an opportunity to turn around because you don't have as much stuff in a.
Venus just has a lot more atmosphere too. I mean, the surface pressure is like 92 times that on Venus than it is on Earth.
I'm sure you could work out some sort of structural definition, though. There's going to be some layer, right? You're going to turn around somewhere, so there's at least two layers. It's just how you define them.
Sure,
yeah. Convection is sort of really the driving process for a lot that goes on in our atmosphere. The main way convection works on our surface, right, so you can imagine sort of a simple diagram here, right? If you think about the equator and the poles, right, on the surface, the sun is mostly over the equatorial regions, right, between, summer, it's directly overhead, fall, spring, right, they're gonna be somewhere in between the two different tropic lines, right? You have the tropic of, what's the one in the top? I can never remember. Cancer, Tropic of Cancer in the Northern Hemisphere, Capricorn in the Southern Hemisphere. The sun goes between these two points, out back and forth throughout the year. Right, so all the direct light is happening between these two lines. So you have a lot of warm air around the equator, cold air at the top. Warm air likes to rise, so it rises up away from the surface, and all the cold air rushes in to fill that space from the poles, right? So you have cool air coming down along the surface this way, warming up at the equator, rising up, and then that moves up where it cools down in the higher latitudes and then drops back down and sort of cycles around, right? That's a simple model, right? So for a slow rotating planet, like Venus, for example, it rotates very slowly. It actually goes backwards a little bit. That's a good model. So Venus's convection would look something like this. The Earth spins a lot faster, so you get higher order modes of convection. Split things out into smaller cells because of the Coriolis effect. That's the reason that water spins different directions in different hemispheres, right? There's a little bit of force, there's a little torque from the rotation of the Earth at different latitudes. So you basically get it breaks into smaller cells at about 30 and 60 degrees latitude in either direction. And so you have the cells adjacent to the equator doing what you would expect them to do, where you bring warm air up from the equator and move it out, but instead of going all the way up, you stop at 30 degrees north and bring some air down. And then you have air coming up at 60 degrees north, bringing it back down to 30 degrees north. And so you have this region of high pressure here at 30 degrees north, low pressure at 60, and then matching in the southern hemisphere. And so what this does is it changes the direction the wind goes along the surface. So between plus and minus 30, wind goes from east to west. And then between 30 and 60, wind goes from west to east. That's why in the United States, the weather goes from the west coast to the east coast. But weather in the tropics goes from the east coast to the west coast. And then up here at the pole, it goes from east to west again, depending on what you're doing, where you're looking. So convection, right, that's just a pure convection effect. And so that's driving what weather happens at different parts of the planet, right? But if you think about what sort of climates exist in these different regions where you have all this warm, moist air along the equator, that's where all the jungles are, right? Along plus 30 and minus 30, there's deserts, because that's a bunch of cool, dry air coming down. There was no water in it anymore. So you don't have any precipitation coming down. It's just dry all the time, and that's why there's deserts. So this is where, right, if you sort of think about Africa, right, you have desert, jungle, desert, right? Really simple explanation for that. It gets more complicated, but Africa is, sort of right there spanning the whole thing. So those are some basics of Earth's atmosphere. Let's talk about other atmospheres now. So there's not just the one, right? So if you think about gas giants, they're just one big atmosphere. Let's do a little recap. I think you talked about this probably last week, but sort of a brief overview of the different properties of the gas giants. If we compare things, we'll sort of use Jupiter as our benchmark. So Jupiter has a radius of about 70,000 kilometers and a mass of about 10 to the 27 kilograms. So you can sort of say that's one, right? Saturn is a little smaller, but a lot less massive. It has a really low density, low enough that it could float in water if you could fit it into a tub big enough. The other three have densities higher than water. Uranus and Neptune have about 30, roughly the same size, 36-35% the size of Jupiter, and mass is about the same, 5%. Really the interesting pattern here, if you look at distance from the sun, right, 5.2, 9.5, 19, 30, you would expect the surface temperature of a planet those distances away from the sun to go down, right? You get further away, there's less light. You can work out what the equilibrium temperature should be for each of these planets just by saying how much light hits it. Imagine their black body radiators, how much should they be putting out on their own. Those equilibrium temperatures for Jupiter would be 110 Kelvin, Saturn 80, Uranus is 60, and Neptune is 45. It sort of follows a nice trend line down. But if you actually go and measure the temperatures that you see, Jupiter is 15 Kelvin hotter than it should be. Saturn is 15 Kelvin hotter than it should be. And Neptune is 15 Kelvin hotter than it should be. But Uranus is right where it's supposed to be. What does that mean for the three planets that are hotter than they should be versus Uranus? What does it mean to have extra heat coming out of you than you should have?
More particles are interacting?
Well, there's lots of different reasons why you might have extra heat. We'll talk about some of them later. But what is it going to sort of, is there a way to ask this question? If you think about the sun, right, it has lots of extra energy on the inside that it's trying to get out. So what process is going to happen if you have lots of extra heat trying to get out? Or something. Say again, Jared?
Radiation.
Radiation is one way of doing it. What about convection? Another way of getting heat out, right? A little tickle. Okay. So if you look at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, on the planets with extra heat trying to come out, you'll see evidence of convection in their atmospheres. You'll see things like cloud patterns. But if you look at Uranus, there's no evidence of convection. It's just sort of a featureless, smooth, because there's not extra heat trying to come out, so there's no way, there's no reason to do convection. It's just going to radiate and do its thing. And then just at the bottom there, there's a little other properties, right? We talked about rings already, we talked about moons, and then they all sort of spin. They're pretty fast spinners. They all spin faster than the Earth does. But really the only other interesting thing here, again, the outlier is Uranus. It's tilted on its side, sort of rolling around the solar system. For whatever reason, maybe that's connected, who knows? We don't know why, maybe it bumped into something, who knows? So let's go through them one by one here. Here it is, it's Jupiter, it's the king of planets. The composition of Jupiter's atmosphere, as you might expect for things in the solar system, right, things in the universe in general, it's mostly made of hydrogen and helium. There's also some ammonia in there, methane, and something called ammonia hydrosulfide, which is NH4HS. That's where the red color comes from. It's a complex organic molecule. It makes it look red. And then you have all these nice stripes and stuff, right? Stripes and like things like the Great Red Spot. So if we look at the colors of the clouds, that tells us what's happening with the convection. The bright stripes, those are called zones. That's gas moving up, and you see the cool top, and it looks white. The darker reddish stripes, those are called bands. And that's gas moving down, and you can see the lower, denser inner layers. So if you could sort of come over and look at Jupiter from the side, the bright stripes would be higher up than the dark stripes. It would sort of look like they have different heights by a little bit. So if you have air moving, if you have gas moving up, gas moving down, those are convection zones, right? So those are the stripes, those are just convection bands, right? So you can sort of imagine you're alternating between, you have gas moving up, gas moving down next to it. So they're gonna alternate back and forth. Steve?
These bands and zones move at different speeds, right?
They do. And that's why you get stuff like this. Because they're doing this next to each other, and along that interface, you're gonna get shear,
and that's going to make it spin. And then you're going to have massive hurricanes, basically, at the interface between the two different convection zones. And so here's a closer up image of that. I'm going to zoom into that because it's really cool. You can even sort of see here, if you look at this, you can sort of get an idea of height here, where the whiter stuff sort of feels like it's on top of the darker, redder stuff, right? This looks like it's sitting on top of something that's lower down. These pictures are really cool. These are from the Juno probe that's currently at Jupiter. If you want to see more cool stuff like this, like oil painting stuff, go on their webpage. There's a ton of this. It's really cool. It's great for like backgrounds and stuff.
Because this isn't an artist's rendering.
This is an actual picture.
Yeah. I can't say no, so this is.
You gotta be careful though, because NASA has so many images from Juno that they do release them to the public and let the public color some of them.
Ah, thank you.
So sometimes colors are not as accurate as they should be.
Okay. This is one of theirs. This is one of NASA's images, so this is going to be relatively close to true color, but everything always is false color on some level. A human has to pick something at some point to color these, so that's not, like if you were there looking with your eye, it wouldn't necessarily look like this color-wise, but it would look like that texture-wise, which is still pretty cool. Or you can see these cyclonic storms, right? These hurricane-looking things. These things can be really big. The Great Red Spot, that's the biggest one. It's basically permanent at this point, I guess. Earth fits inside that. So that's big, right?
Two times over.
Talk about, being in the eye of the storm or whatever. Saturn is next up. It has roughly similar composition in terms of the atmosphere, right? Mostly hydrogen and helium, methane, ammonia. There's some water ice crystals in there too. So you sort of see, if you look in detail, sometimes you'll see sort of like little white patches. Those are like ice clouds, basically. Obviously, there's the rings, not part of the atmosphere. Saturn is really interesting. It has a polar hexagon. Can see it here. These are pictures taken over a period of time. It's changing color over time. It's basically dredging up. It's sort of a series of vortexes that make a hexagon shape. I have a video that will show how it works in a second. But it dredges up different material that reflects different colors of light because it's made of slightly different compositions. But that's a weird thing in the solar system, just a hexagon sitting on top there. Let's see if we can play the video here. So, here's a still from the video, but let's watch the actual video. I don't know. I did this already. I accepted your cookies.